thank you for joining us for The Art of the Score. Tonight's guest is composer Bruce Broughton. Mr. Broughton has amassed hundreds of memorable credits in film and television, including Dallas, Quincy, and Hawaii Five-0 on the small screen, and in feature films, indelible scores like The Boy Who Could Fly, Young Sherlock Holmes, Silverado, The Rescuers Down Under, and Tombstone. Tell me, first of all, where your love of music first began for you, and what was the instrument that you were initially drawn to?
I sort of couldn't avoid it. My family was musical. I had a grandfather who was a composer, an uncle who was a songwriter, an aunt who was a pianist. My parents both played instruments. My brother's a musician. You couldn't help it. And I grew up, my parents worked for the Salvation Army, which was a musical organization because they had their bands and all that kind of stuff. So when I was a kid, I went every summer to their music camps where I learned elementary theory, which, as it turned out, was about as much theory as I was going to learn in the first semester of a college course. So it was really rather substantial, and I started playing piano, and at the same time learned to play a trumpet, and later switched trumpet to horn. I was always a mediocre brass player, but it gave me an idea of how to write for instruments other than the piano, about breathing lines, how to place notes, and all that kind of stuff. So it was the beginning of my ambition, I guess, as an orchestrator. So as I got older, I found the piano a great instrument to spend a lot of time on, particularly since I was sort of an indoors boy. And I would just play and, read a lot of different music, and I became a good sight reader. And I continued my piano studies, until I was in college, and after that I really took up composing much more seriously than I had.
How do you think music defined you and who you were?
I don't know. I guess that because I spent so much time playing the piano, I became the kid who played the piano, and I was good at it. So if there was a school talent thing or a school show, I would play the piano, or I would be in the band playing the horn, whatever. I was all around music. I remember when I was in high school, I was the accompanist of the school choir, and at that time, that school had no other music program than the choir, so to be the pianist for the choir was really kind of a big deal, because I was like the school's pianist. Whenever they had a play or anything, that was me. So I never thought about being defined by it. But
Well, I guess what I really wanted to know is, what made it such a perfect fit for you, music?
Well, I can tell you what makes it a perfect fit for me right now. Mm-hmm. It just has no ceiling. It's one of the few things that I know that you just can't hit the top. I suppose there are other ones. I suppose science is like that, and all sorts of the arts are like that. But for me, I look at various composers I admire. I mean, guys who are dead, some of them are still alive. Some of them are friends of mine who have techniques that I don't have, or who can do things that I particularly like. And I think, I can learn how to do that, or I should learn how to do that, or, how did he do that? Let me see if I can learn to do that. And then I find my own spin on it, and I look at my own music, and I think, I think I can make that better, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of the most amazing things in the world. I mean, I'm grateful to whatever powers there be that, music was part of the stuff that we get to use and live in, because it's been so amazing. I never get tired of listening to music, and there's so much variety to it. There's certain kinds of music I'm not crazy about, certain kinds that I'm nuts about, certain kinds that I still need to learn. I'm always amazed at how much variety there is and what's meaningful to somebody else in a different style of music or a certain idea of music in their mind. But for me, it's just, it has no ceiling. That's the best thing.
Yeah. Well, when did film and television composition come into your consciousness?
Well, that's kind of funny. Obviously I have a lot of friends who are film composers, and I often hear them say, when I was a kid, I was watching the movies. I wanted to be a film composer. To tell you the truth, I don't think I was even aware of music in movies until I was probably, maybe my mid to late teens. I went to movies as a as somebody to be entertained. You know, I went to movies as a moviegoer, which actually turns out to be a good thing. Later, when I went to school and became a composer and took a degree in composing, as I, before I graduated, I had to start thinking seriously about how I was going to make a living in this thing. And I didn't know what kind of music I wanted to do and how I was going to make a living being a composer. So one day I'm driving up, I think it was La Brea Boulevard or something, listening to the radio. Some song was on, and I'm getting all worked up about the song. I'm thinking, oh, man, what a cool song. It makes me feel really good. And I thought, oh, that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to write music that affects people. I'd like to write music that could make people feel something.
Mm-hmm.
And then and this all went on in about 10 seconds in my head. I thought, well, okay, what kind of music would that be? Should I be a songwriter? I thought, no, that form's too short. I'd like to write something that takes, you know, it's longer. And I thought, movie music, that'd be great, because that way I'd get a big audience, I'd get people in a dark room, and they're just, you know, the screen is huge, and the music's coming at them, that kind of music is emotional, and would actually make people feel this or that. So that was the beginning of my desire to try and get into the movies. And it affected at the same time my feeling about music in general, because even to the present time, right, I try to write music that is engaging by the people who play it, that they're interested in playing it. I want it to be interesting to the people who hear it. I'm not interested in writing music that is just music for music's sake and no one's going to pay any attention to it. I really want people to get engaged in it.
Mm-hmm.
And movies provided that opportunity for me. And more than I could ever guess, it gave me a huge technique, because in movies you just never know what kind of music you're going to be writing. You know, you could be doing comedy or suspense, you could be doing a space show or a western show or a cartoon or an animated thing or whatever. You could be doing a jingle or a theme park, whatever it is. Have all these different styles. So it has a lot of stuff to it that was great for me. I think if I had become an academic composer, I would have had a very different kind of career and maybe a different take on music, but it seemed to suit me really well.
Well, another important aspect of film composing, I would think, is your role as an assistant storyteller, and you have to have the ability to read a film to determine what it needs from you.
Yeah, I know you're saying that off the top of your head, but assistant, I wouldn't say assistant. You're actually a storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have a sense of film and a sense of story, a sense of character, then your music is useless. Because actually what we do, it's an odd thing, I tell students this, when you're hired to write music for a film, you're really not hired for your music. You're hired for your storytelling ability. They don't come to you and say, you know, I really love that flute concerto you wrote, and I'd like a piece like that in my movie, because I think it would work really well. What they do is you write the music for the scene. They'll say, I want this scene to be more terrifying, or I want it to be less terrifying, or I want it to be more romantic, or I want the actors to seem taller or shorter or more beautiful, or, you know, whatever it is. Those are not musical things. They don't say, I want to hear French horn. Well, sometimes they do, but usually try to ignore that. They don't say, I want an orchestra of 18 oboes or 32 harps or something like that. They just say, I want the character to be this, I want the story to be that, and they leave it to you to figure that out musically.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have any sense of how music relates emotionally to character and to story development and to issues, you know, as basic as personality and movement and timing and all that kind of stuff, then movie music is not for you. Movie music also is essentially a compliment. So you have to be able to know when to lie low. You need to know when you can get out and shout.
Mm-hmm.
You need to know when to be able to make the phrase do something very, very, very specific, because what you're looking for is success, obviously, with the film and with the audience, but you're also looking, frankly, for success with the director, the person you're working for. And when the director, you know, when the director says, man, that's it, you got it, you know, that really works, that's great, that's a lot different than having somebody say, what a beautiful melody, what a beautiful voicing.
Right.
I love the way you use the horns and the bassoons together, and the way the clarinet, you know, all the musical stuff, it's really secondary to what the effect of the music is.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not really, you're assisting the director in his vision or her vision of trying to tell the story, of trying to make the movie as believable as possible. But in that element, you, like all the other people, are really a storyteller in a very specific way, using a very specific creative ability.
Well, that being said, and I don't know if you've ever run into this in your career, but you've done a lot of work. If you run across a project that you're not necessarily as emotionally invested in, does the music suffer?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I have to say, I think in the scores that people like the most of mine, the ones that they, you know, tell me about all the time, like Silverado or Tombstone or
mm-hmm.
Rescuer's Zone or something like that, all of these films I had an investment in. I had a real emotional investment in. I liked the films. I liked the story. I could understand it. I could get into it. I was comfortable with it. I knew what I wanted to do. If the director had a different idea, I was open to it, to be able to explore different ways of being able to get this or that. Occasionally, I tried not to work on movies I had no investment in. I tried always to find something that I could hang my musical story on. But, you know, some aren't as interesting as others, and some are, I would say, some things that I did were probably more workmanlike than inspired.
Do you kind of look upon yourself as having a particular sound, or do you prefer to look at yourself as someone that that tailors your sound to whatever you're working on?
Well, I would like to be the latter, you know. And I tell people sometimes I don't really know what my sound is, and then they just laugh. Because my sound obviously is very obvious to everybody else, but not to me. I mean, I'd like to think that I have a huge variety, and I can point out one score and contrast it with another score and say, see, these are completely different styles and blah, 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 blah,
mm-hmm.
blah, blah. But in fact, I think that I and probably most of my friends have a very strong personality that you can pretty much tell that this is a score by me, you know. Having said that, you try not to repeat yourself, and you try not to wear the same suit of clothes in every scene, but you know, I don't know. I mean, I guess what it is that there is a way of reacting to film, reacting to story, reacting to situations, which is probably common to everybody who comes to it. So that if you take, I don't know, two different composers who have different styles. The things that they're looking for in the film, the things that they're looking for in the story, and the things that they think that they can help the director with are probably somewhat different. And if the director carefully chooses the composer, he or she probably will choose the composer based upon their understanding of the script, their understanding of the story, and their musical personality, or maybe their physical personality,
mm-hmm.
to be able to help them in that, you know, in that chore. I think for this reason, some composers and directors have had very long associations together. Like the most obvious one is Spielberg and John Williams, but there's also, you know, Mancini had people he worked with. Blake Edwards, he did a lot of stuff with Blake Edwards. Jerry Goldsmith had Frank Schaffner, and then they had all these guys because the directors feel very comfortable talking with the composers on a human level, on a personal level. And they're also very comfortable in talking to them when they get around to the music of what they see in the scene that may be somewhat different, or what they need to have augmented or diminished or changed, in full confidence that the composer is going to be able to understand what they're talking about.
Right, right. Excuse me if this is a pedestrian question, because I'm not incredibly musically inclined, but if you're scoring a film, if you're kind of spotting where to place music and developing a medley, do you often run into a problem where the beats of the actual scene run in opposition to where you think the music should naturally go?
Actually, that's not a pedestrian question. That's actually a pretty slick question, because I've noticed over the years, like, I used to do an awful lot of television. I did years of television series, which I really enjoyed. But every once in a while, I would get a show that was just really hard to do. It was hard to place the music in it. Once we figured out where the music was going to go, they had scenes that were just really difficult to write. And I realized that the timing was all off. I could, after a while, because particularly when I worked on series, they would have two or three different editors working on it, and I would know that this editor, this particular editor, was one that you're going to have a hard time working on his movie, because the way he or she cut was just kind of lumpy in terms of timing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the other ones would be exactly opposite. You know, they'd be much more graceful. I mean, things would just sort of fall into place. I mean, I can give you an example of that. The lady who edited Silverado, Carol Littleton, she's a spectacular editor.
Terrific.
She's also a musician. She was a former musician. I mean, she played oboes. So, I mean, she understands music and she understands timing. When she does a scene, I mean, she lays the thing out, and it has a certain kind of, you know, flow in it. And those are the kind of people that help make the music sound like something. If the picture is awkwardly cut, the music's going to be awkwardly placed. There's just no way around it. And I mean, sometimes when you're spotting a film, you'll ask the director, "Can you give me another second on that look, or can you give me another second and a half, or can you give me this, or you know, something like that?" Because you know, as a composer, you can use that to be able to shape the character a little bit more. Whereas they've been cutting it without the music, and they're just sort of imagining how it's going to go. Where it's difficult these days is with the prevalence of temp tracks being wall-to-wall and being able to be put in so easily now with digital technology, they will often cut to the piece that they're tracking it with, thinking that, you know, that's the way to make the picture look good. Well, it sort of does, because it matches the music, but when you take that music out and have to add original music, your timing is all a jumble. So, that's not a dumb question. It's not a pedestrian question. It's a really good question.
Well, I do find that, and we've spoken to Carol Littleton on the show, too, and she is terrific. But great editing has a rhythm of its own. I mean, it finds the rhythm of the piece.
There was actually, I mean, thinking of Carol and Silverado, there's a scene in Silverado which is the first scene when the four guys actually are riding together. They ride across the across the desert and stop, and then they meet the wagon train. And the theme plays. It's very, very big. It's the first big statement of the theme, other than the main title. And there was a spot after we recorded it where there was a big chord, a real big downbeat that came not on the beginning of a cut, but sort of like into the cut. And it was always awkward, but I couldn't change it because it was the theme. And if I had mucked around with the theme, it just would have sounded stupid, you know, so I just let it go. And when we were watching it, the director, Larry Kasdan, said, "Bruce, you think we could cut the music so that the chord would happen on the horses?" And Carol immediately got him and says, "No, I can take care of it. I can take care of it." And thank God for her, you know, because I look at that every time and I have to laugh, because it's very graceful. But that was Carol helping me out.
Yeah.
But I mean, in a case like that, if we had had somebody who, as a film editor, who was not sympathetic or sensitive to that, then we would have had an awkward scene. Or, at the same time, if I'd had a music editor who had to go make that cut and was also not particularly sensitive to the music, it would just be an awkward, lumpy, awkward bit. And maybe I'd be the only guy who'd know it, but the film would suffer. Whereas right now, it's a little bit of elegance, you know, for 2 seconds.
And, you know, I never considered that the score could actually bring out possible flaws in the rhythm of the editing.
Well, I mean, sometimes the score can add to it. And there's a film that will remain nameless by a film composer who will also remain nameless, who is a very good, I mean, he was a very good composer and very successful, all that kind of stuff. But I mean, this is years ago. It's an action film. And at some point, everybody, I mean, it's getting to the point in the film where everything's coming apart. everybody's going to die, and they're running around, oh my God, oh, this, I mean, all this hysteria going on. And for whatever reason, the composer decided to do it with long notes. Da, da, da. Okay, so it's like when you look at it with the picture, it's like people are running through this thick oil. And it's like nobody can get there fast enough because the music is so slow. And, you know, one of the problems of the picture when it came out was that the pacing was bad. And I thought, well, no kidding. You know, now I don't know what the picture was like on its own, but the music didn't help it. And I remember a few years ago I was working on the sequel to Bambi 2.
Mm-hmm.
And they had that, they had done a temp track on it, and it was a good temp track. I mean, animation is very hard to temp adequately because the movements are so quick. But they had, you know, whoever had done it had done a really good job. And I listened to it, and we talked about it. We talked what we liked, what we didn't like. The director told me what he wanted, and blah, blah, blah. So I went home, and I looked at it. And the first thing, of course, I did is I took out the temp track, and I just watched the film on its own. And all of a sudden, the film came alive, because the temp track was like glop on the movie. Mm. It was music that had been written for other purposes, not for this film, and it had just been put in because it more or less played the scene. But it didn't really play anything in the scene. It didn't have any life of its own. It's sort of like this Frankensteinian thing, you know, that lurches through the picture going wherever it went. And I realized that the picture had been made very sensitively, with a lot of care, that you really couldn't get when the score was just, you know, thrown together. No, not thrown together, but, you know, it was just a temp score. It wasn't the original music. So, yeah, I mean, I think the music, the timing is a very, 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 very important thing.
Yeah. Well, Silverado is one of my all-time favorite scores, and I've always been a film score junkie. So, and Silverado is right up there at the top for me. But that's a very, a very big, bold score. I mean, it kind of elicits the feeling and the scope of the film in a very special way. But is there a delicate balance between accentuating elements of a movie with a score and overpowering them?
Yeah. Silverado, when I first saw it, I didn't... I'm choosing my words here, but because this is not a criticism. But when I first saw the movie, I didn't see it as a big movie.
Mm-hmm.
It, for one thing, it had four guys in it who nobody knew. I mean, these guys were not stars. I mean, they had been in other movies, but they weren't stars like they are now. I mean, Danny Glover he'd been in a couple of movies, and Kevin Costner had not been in any movie except as a corpse. And Kevin Kline had been in a few movies, but now, I mean, we see these guys and go, oh, my Lord. You know, but at that time, the biggest star, I think, in the film was John Cleese. And that was not the way to have a big Western, you know. And then they didn't have crowds of thousands of people filling the streets. I mean, it was you know, adequately done, all that kind of stuff. But, it wasn't big, 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 big. And when the director said, he said, I'm trying to make a movie here for people who've never seen a Western. And I said, well, like who? He said, well, think of it. He said, kids, he said, you and I grew up with Westerns. He said, but kids haven't seen Westerns. They don't grow up with Westerns. And in fact, the last successful Western before Silverado was Blazing Saddle,
mm-hmm.
So, which was a parody. And once you parody something, it's mostly dead. So the thing that he wanted was a traditional sounding, he wanted a big Hollywood traditional Western score, which meant to me like Jerome Maras, because that to me is like, that's a really Hollywood score. And after that came Elmer Bernstein with his Magnificent Seven, and that sort of set the stage for whatever that style was. So I knew right then what kind of score he wanted, and we put it on, I put it on big, I put it on energetic, and once I got into the film, I realized that there was an enormous amount of energy in the picture. It was a picture about friendship. It focuses on these four guys who try to separate and have to keep coming back together, and you know they're friends from somewhere, and the story of family is a big thing in there, and it's also a film about power. I mean, these guys are all really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
The bad guys are very powerful, and good guys are very powerful, like myself. So it set itself up to take the score that he was asking for, that he wanted, and then suddenly it became a big film, you know. But some people felt at the time that the music was too big for the film. Over the years, it's all settled down, and they realized that the film and the music work really well together. The music just, I don't know, just enormously energetic, but part of that energy was because it was my first major chance at a film, and I think I was so excited. Point things up in a scene by making a musical comment here and a musical comment there and all that stuff. But you can also slow a picture down by making so many comments in the scene that you ask the audience to look at this and look at that and look at this and look at this and look at that, when actually all you should be doing is standing back and asking them to take in the entire scene.
Mm.
It's a funny technique. Like, there's an old story of can't think of what her name is. An actress who complained to Betty. What's her name? The one with the big eyes.
Betty Davis.
Betty Davis. Betty Davis apparently complained to one of the Warner Brothers, saying, "You know, Mr. Warner," he said, "in this movie, either I go down the stairway or Mr. Steiner comes down the stairway, but we're not coming down together." It's because Steiner had this way of being able to kind of Mickey Mouse move it, you know, and it can sometimes can work really against the scene. So,
yeah.
So in all of that energy, it's a way sometimes of, like, in the animation, like thinking of Warner Brothers, in the old Warner Brothers animation, that kind of energy is put directly into the Mickey Mousing because it makes the gags bigger, makes the gags funny, and you can draw attention to it. You know? So the whole thing of energy is it's interesting. Some composers have a lot of it. Some composers really prefer not to use it too much at all.
I want to ask you something that probably follows up on that point, because I hear from everyone, all the creative talents that have a large body of work like you do, when it comes to comedy, they say that's the killer genre for them, that's very difficult. And when you're scoring a comedy, is it tricky not to play the laughs necessarily?
Well, first of all, a director told me years ago, he said, "You should never do comedy." And I said, "Why is that?" And he said, "Because they can't see your talent." And in that, I thought when he first said that he was talking to me directly. But I realized that what he was saying was really, he was making a broad statement that comedy is a very difficult medium to do, because it relies so much on timing. And you find that a lot of comic actors are really very fine dramatic actors, but
mm-hmm.
They get overlooked because they're doing comedy. And comedy is one of those things that everybody likes, so it can't be that hard, you know. Actually, comedy is really hard, and I got a clue into it years ago working with Alan Alda. We had worked on one movie where we didn't know each other, and we got along, and I learned a few things from him about this and that. But it was on the second movie, that we were working on a scene, and he pointed at one spot and he said, You cover that laugh. You cover that joke." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, when the thing happens, you've got music on it. You need to open up the joke." And I said, No, I let it play." And he said, "No, actually you didn't." And I said, "Okay, let's look at it." So he was right, but I was right. I mean, I had actually, there was something where the character tosses a Coke thing into a can and he misses it, which is the gag, and then he goes back and he does it again. So what had happened, the Coke thing falls on the ground, and I left a space for it, and then I brought the music in. But what I had done is I had brought the music in too soon. You know, I had left a space, but I hadn't left enough time for the laugh to register.
Mm.
Now, he, being a comedic actor and having a great understanding of timing and what it takes to have a laugh, he knew immediately that I'd stomped on the line. No, I hadn't stomped on the line, but I'd stomped on the gag. And I thought, oh, gee, that's really interesting. This is like, I mean, years later, I thought, this is like what Bernard Herrmann would do. Because Bernard Herrmann was great at being able to wait for the audience to take in whatever was on the screen. In his case, he was doing suspense or terror or something like that. He would wait for the audience to get an eye pull and get their whole system working with what was on the screen. And then he'd bring in the music and bring everybody out of their seats. But it works in comedy as well. If you play all the gags, you're not playing any. All you're doing is you're just squashing things flat as a pancake.
Right, right.
You know, you have to, usually if you're late, if you're after the fact, you can make a comment and you can sort of fill up the laugh, make the laugh linger a little bit. When I was working with Alan on the first time, he's really good at this stuff. And I would play through the scene and he would look at me with a straight face and he said, "Well, that's good. So you got three extra laughs out of that scene." I'm thinking, huh? Where? What did I do? You know? But I mean, he just knew, because that's part of his work, part of his training. And I've watched comedians do this. They sometimes when you hear comedians talk with each other, there's like an interview thing that you're lucky enough to get. They will talk about beats. They will talk about timing, because the whole thing with comedy is all about timing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in films in general, it's all about time, but comedy is particularly difficult. And some guys do it very, very, very well, and some guys don't do it very well at all. Henry Mancini used to do it really well, and he did it by mostly staying away. Like some of those Inspector Clouseau movies, some of the Pink Panther movies, he would let Clouseau do all the silly things, just one gag after another. And in the background, he would just be playing a little pantomime, a little theme, you know, a little ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da.
Right.
And he wasn't going to get in the way of the timing. He wasn't going to stomp on any jokes. He wasn't going to be responsible for taking the gag somewhere else. He just let the guy do his own thing, and it worked out very well that way.
Yeah. You know, I was listening. I've been listening to your work all week as kind of a refresher for the interview, and Betsy's Wedding is one of the pieces that I've been listening to, and it's beautiful,
yeah.
Beautiful work. I repeat collaborations with directors, one of which I'm crazy about. He's been on the show several times, Peter Himes, and you've worked with him several times. What is the benefit for you in working with certain people multiple times?
Well, you know, it's a little like dating, and I'm not the one who made that up. That actually, I heard Jerry Goldsmith say it, but I think it's actually true. The first time you're out with somebody, you really don't know. You're just not sure. You don't know whether you should go out and have something to eat, or a movie, or is it a comedy? Do they like, you know, what are they like? The second time, if you get to a second time, then you have a much better idea of what the person's interested in from the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And each subsequent meeting, you know, you hope to get a little more involved. I think it's the same thing with composers and directors. When you first meet, you know, you probably know something about each other. Like when I met Peter, I knew some of his movies, and I had an idea of some of his music, and he had done a couple of movies with Jerry Goldsmith. Like he did Outland, which I thought was, you know, I really enjoyed the movie, and I really enjoyed the score. So I had an idea, really. But with Peter, the thing with working with Peter that I always found interesting was that he's a real, how can I say this, he's a real worker. You know, he enjoys doing movies, he enjoys working on movies, but he sees it as a job and a craft, you know, all that kind of stuff. And if you end up doing something that he doesn't like, and this happened, you know, if you end up doing something he doesn't like, he doesn't say, okay, that's it, you're out of here. You know, go find me somebody who knows what they're doing. He's not like that at all. He just says, as he said to me one time, he says, well, you're the one who screwed it up, so you fix it. And so it gives you the chance to really do it, you know, and then you have to really pay attention to what he's saying and what he's talking about. He's very articulate. He's very specific. And he doesn't mince words. I mean, he gives you a chance to talk. And if you can convince him, great. If you can't, you know, you better figure out another way of doing it. I mean, I picked up so many practical things from working with Peter. I remember one time I was working on, I don't know what movie it was, but my orchestrator was, I don't know, he was either trying to make some points or be nice to me, or I don't know what he was doing, but he was talking to Peter, and he said, you know, Bruce really worked hard on this thing. He worked, you know, night and day, and he works lots of times, just, you know, all through the night. And Peter looked at him and said, I don't care. Everybody works hard. And I thought, yeah, you're right. Everybody works hard. Everybody stays up late. I mean, he stood up late, you know, doing night shoots and all that kind of stuff. And I thought, isn't that funny? Because, you know, composers sometimes think that they're the only people in the world who are creative. They think they're the only people in the world who have to work hard. They think they're the only people in the world who are insecure about their work. And it turns out that everybody's like that. Everybody's
mm-hmm.
working hard. Everybody's trying to make the thing work as well as they possibly can, you know? You can't get on any movie where somebody is going to say to you, I'll just do a crappy job because that's really all I'm looking for. They want you to do your best, you
right,
know?
Right.
And Peter would, I mean, Peter would just get in your face and go, excuse me, you know, do it. I mean, do it like this. I want it like this, or that's the problem. Can you fix this and do that? You know, how are you going to do it? He lets you do what you're going to do, but I always found that part to be, I mean, I've thought about him for years saying a lot of those things because he would say the hard thing, but he was always right.
Well, and when you have those conversations with directors and they offer you direction, I would think the kind of direction that you prefer are conversations about what you want to feel during this moment, and not, you know, you need this specific instrument or cue here.
Yeah, I mean, you hope. I mean, directors are people, like composers are people, right? They come in all types. I mean, sometimes you have some people who are nice people. You have some people who are difficult to work with, and you know, that. So you try to work with a different personality. So you hope that if you've done something that is not going to go down well, or is let's be creative, that's not along the lines of the director's vision, whatever that is, you hope that you can get the information in a way that you can still walk out of the room with your head high, you know, because some people can be, you know, difficult when things aren't going the way they want, because they've got their own anxieties. But I've had things where, remember I was working on a movie with the guy, a very nice guy, a good director, and we got on fine, and the movie went well, and all that kind of stuff, but I was recording the scene, and he walked out, and he said, in the nicest way, he said, you know, this is not what you said you were going to do. I said, really? And he said, yeah, you said you were going to do blah, 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 blah. And he said, this was going to be a jazz scene, and it was going to come off the other cue, and it was going to do such and such and so and so. I looked at what I'd done, and what I'd done definitely was not a jazz thing. So he looked at me and said, what are we going to do? I said, leave me alone for 15 minutes. Go away. Go away for 15 minutes and come back, and we'll see. You know. So he walked away, and it was all, you know, it was all friendly, but I'm sure that he had the anxiety, and I figured out who I had in the room and what I could do, and he came back, and I played him a jazz thing. You know, I was able to rework the piece, fortunately, being able to work the piece so that it played the scene, and it was along the lines of what I said I had done and along the lines of what he had expected and what he wanted. So in that particular case, He was very specific. He was very gentlemanly. He was very firm, and fortunately, I was competent and I could get the thing done. You know, and I knew what he wanted and what I had screwed up with. So, you do have things that happen that aren't exactly the way people intend, and you can have a film that goes really, really well, and then just have one scene that, you know, it's completely wrong, and then you end up doing it over again, or fixing it on the stage, or, you know, whatever you do. But that's sort of the creative process.
Mm-hmm. A few years ago, I heard an interview with an actor, and he was talking about the kind of the choices he makes in any given scene, and a lot of times they're not the obvious choices. And he cited an example of, I think, the Challenger shuttle disaster, and he was watching the witnesses of the disaster. And they were all looking up, and you would expect them to go into hysterics, but they didn't. They were all very still and quiet and kind of disbelieving. And he said, you know, as a creative choice, sometimes you want to take the opposite of the obvious when you're making a choice. Are there moments in your music where you kind of try to work in counterpoint to what is expected?
Yeah, I suppose so. You know, I don't think anybody has the answer to all the problems, all the solutions. I mean, I don't think anybody has the way of doing it. And I notice it with some composers, some of my friends, I'll look at what they do with a scene and think, man, I would never in a thousand years think of that. I would never do that for a scene like this. But boy, does that work great, you know. So, I remember I said that one time to Tom Newman on, what was it, The Player. Mm. He had a scene in there that I sat there and thought, why does this work? But man, this works great. And I said to him afterwards, I said, you know, the thing I like about listening to your music is I know that it's not something I would ever do. It's not something I would ever think of. And I have to pay attention to it as to why it works and why it's working so well, because it's just so different from what I do, you know. And I think there are some times when you're working on a scene, the frustrating thing, I guess, is you hope that you're getting the scene as close as you possibly can get. But there's always that nagging suspicion that there's another way of doing it that's probably better, probably closer. I've seen some guys, some composers, like years ago, Billy Goldenberg used to do an awful lot of television. Billy was extraordinarily sensitive to scenes. I've seen Jerry Goldsmith get so close to a scene don't know, it doesn't, I mean, they like it, but it doesn't do it for me. I'm not sure I got it. So, and I know this isn't a good answer to your question. I think what it is that playing against the scene, playing with the scene, you just try and do everything you can think of. That's, or you don't do everything, but you try to go through all the solutions you have at hand in order to be able to get the best one to make the most positive statement, most positive reaction for the scene, because you really want, you know, you want the picture to be successful. I mean, you want to be, there are all sorts of reasons. I mean, you want to be successful because you want the director to hire you again. You want people to say, oh, what a great composer he is, and blah, 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 blah. But basically, I think that when anybody sits down to work on a picture, whether it's a director or whether it's a producer, a writer, or a studio head, or a composer, or a musician, whoever it is, everybody wants it to be successful. They want their job to be successful. They want it to be as good as possible. And so you're always looking around for better ways of doing it. You're always looking around for a more interesting solution or something that will get you out of your rut. You know, if you've been doing, so if you're starting to get identified with a certain kind of music, you know, maybe it's time to take a vacation or to start looking at another kind of film. Because you don't want to get stale, you don't want to get boring, you don't want to bore the audience, you don't want the audience to get disinterested in the film, get them out of the story, you don't want them to start thinking about your voicings, they should be thinking about the relationship on the screen, you know. I don't know that I'm really answering your question, but I know that all those things are the things that we all think about as we're sitting there working on our films.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when I listen to your body of work, one of the things that distinguishes it are, it's just a glorious, excuse me, a glorious sense of melody. And I find that in music in general, that's missing today, by and large. But in film music, it seems to be more and more replaced by, you know, film music is kind of an extension of the sound effects in a way in a lot of films. Do you find that troubling?
You're in a pet peeve of mine. Melody has always had a hard time. Melody has a hard time, and forget film music for a minute. Melody has a hard time in pop music. It has a hard time in concert music. And those big Tchaikovsky symphonies that everybody loves to hear, they're not the ones that people hold up as being the standard of great writing because they've got those melodies in them. But they're the ones that people go to hear. And if in concert music you think back on all the pieces that you really love, you're probably thinking about a piece that has a great melody.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably something that sticks in the ear. And in pop music, the one thing that's the hardest thing to get out as a songwriter is a ballad, because they're, yeah, it's a ballad. I mean, geez, you know. But ballads last forever and ever and ever.
Yeah.
And when you get to the movies, it's the big themes that identify the picture, that when you hear this theme, you think of the movie. You think of all, you know, people think of Silverado. And rather, if they hear Silverado, unless they've never seen the movie, they think about that movie. They just do.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's associated with that. If you hear even the theme from Jaws, such as it is, a two-note motive, I mean, they think of a fish, they think of a shark, and actually there's nothing that relates the music to the action, except that they were put together on a piece of film.
Mm.
But melody is the hardest thing to get through. I don't know why it's so easily despised, but it's not popular right now. For that matter, film scores that are really emotional, big and emotional, they're not particularly popular right now either. Sound effects, I think partly because the digital technology, sound effects have become now a matter of sound design. In the old days, people could find sound effects. They would record a dog bark, and you know, that would be it. They would have maybe 10 dog barks. Which one do you like? Now they have all sorts of ways of being able to get to a dog bark and being able to change the bark, being able to change the pitch, and the length and the time and the volume, the resonance and all that kind of stuff just through a computer. And music has become much more, film music has become much more, it's become less, much less specific than what it used to be.
Yeah.
It's also become much less, I think, important. Mainly because there's too much of it. I mean, a lot of pictures have just wall-to-wall music, way too much music. to have any effect. If you look at a picture from 25 years ago, 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, there's not that much music in these films. You know, they let the action actually play, and the effects let the effects do the thing. And the music comes in when it needs to be done.
Yeah,
it's a different style. It's a different time. It'll change again. There might be a time when melody becomes important. It might become a different kind of a melody. But I know that when people go to hear their old standards, what an old standard is basically some song that you can sing and that you can remember. And then when you hear those first two or three or four or five notes, you think, oh, that's blah, blah, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Not when you hear the rhythm loop, you know, underneath.
Right. Yeah, I agree with you completely. My last question, this is something I always like to ask the composers we welcome on the show. If you were to recommend three essential scores outside of your own, which ones would they be?
I'm not a great score historian. I will draw a blank on it.
Well, I know that Max Steiner was a big hero for you in terms of film music, wasn't he?
Yeah, I like Steiner, and I like his technique. I think from that time, a score that I would probably look at with a lot of admiration would be Robin Hood of Korngold. You know, that's a spectacular score, and it's so well written, so well put together, and it works great with the film.
Yeah.
I think of something like Planet of the Apes, Jerry's, because it's so inventive.
Yeah.
And for that matter, even Chinatown. Chinatown has so many different things happening in it, so many different styles, so many different ways of working the film. I don't know. I would. Well, I mean, even Spartacus, I would find it easier to identify some composers
mm-hmm.
more than specific films, because the composers I particularly admire, the guys like Korngold, certainly Steiner, but Korngold, Jerry Goldsmith, Alex North, Bernard Herrmann, not so much for his music, but for the way he used it to create great atmospheric tension
right. And
excitement, you know. I mean, you know, a few guys like that. Those are the guys who I look up to, who I have tried to, you know, whose works I'll actually go into and enjoy. And in large part, I can usually enjoy their music away from the film as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's substantial enough, but it's not necessary to be that good. But sometimes they were really that good just on their own.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you that I think you're phenomenal, and I've enjoyed
well,
your.
Thank you.
I've
hope
enjoyed
that part
your.
Goes in your show.
Yeah, I'm gonna move that right to the top, so everyone knows right at the beginning.
I'm gonna record it and give it to my wife.
I have so enjoyed your work for so many years, and this has been a great pleasure for me to have the opportunity to speak to you.